This morning, let's give Cordell a warm welcome as he shares with us his toolkit for reinvention.
Good morning. Welcome. Everybody looks like they're all here. Everybody, okay, good. I'm just kind of checking the energy levels. I would love for this to be interactive rather than sort of lecture-y. Now, I'm going to share things that work for me, but I don't want it to be just all about me, because all of us have accumulated and cultivated strategies, and some work well. And Mike, if you'd like to share a moment where we can, present it and maybe dissect it to understand what's in it that makes it work. I'm always like, what made it work? I was the kid who took everything apart I survived taking my mother's bull of a watch apart. I heard it had 18 jewel movement or something. I had to see them. I'd seen the Sinbad movie, and all the jewels, and I just had to see them. They lied. I saw no jewels. Well, what I did see was capital punishment. I did not take the television apart. My mother, in her wisdom, that works. In her wisdom, noticing my tendency, had one of our friends who was an electrician and repairman come to the house after church, open the TV, and tell me how it worked, and point out to me what would definitely kill me if I touched it, and how bad it would kill me about the smoke and the charring and how bad it would be. And so my mother said, one day I'm going to be in the kitchen. He's going to be back there trying to see how people get in the box. So my mother, I will say, is responsible not only for my birth, but for my surviving to adulthood. Mom, thank you. What I'd love to do is, I prefer a little bit of informality. So feel free if you have a question. Even though we have a tendency, we prefer in this typical, presentation to at the end address questions. But if you have one and it feels urgent, we can at least hold it up for a second. And if it's something that maybe should wait, I'll go, well, we'll get back to that. But if it's something that might enhance or elevate what's going on, then we can take it sort of in real time. I prefer to at least have the option. So feel free. I'm going to base my discussion not on every one of the times when I was like on the brink and had to do something, but on a particular one that has a lot of elements that I like to focus on, and it happened early in my life, and many of the parts have served me in good stead over time, so I like it as a good example. And as I say, if I go too fast, I've been known to accelerate, oblivious to myself, but the rate can go up, and I don't mean to do that, but excitement has an effect. So you can just kind of either go, let's see, how would you do that? Any gesture. There's a lot of body language that would work. Even the eyebrow. I'll interpret that as something slow to act. Okay. Let's see. So I, in my last decade or so, as the technology around brain imaging has evolved, I like connecting understandings that we have either gained through intuition or just smart people doing great research, but without the scanning technology, they make good guesses, but we've got some tools now to let us really tie things together, in a less theoretical way, because we can verify things. At least we believe it if we see it. So we have some new tools. So I like to couch certain things in, if I can, support it with the new tools, because when we get out of the realm of theory to the realm of, well, we saw it, then our belief moves accordingly. And as our belief goes, that's what we do. We actually do what we believe, whether it's true or not. So I like things that enhance our ability to grab a tool and then run with it. Good morning, Frederick. How are you? Good.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. No, ever. In your life, no matter what happens from here on out, you never have to say, I'm sorry, okay? Frederick is, he has lived a life of service, I will say. And so there's a point where you go, sorry, no. You get to stumble. Everybody does. But sorry, no. We're always ahead no matter what you do from here on out. But don't over it. Don't abuse that license. So I'm going to tell a story first, and then I will stop at places where it makes sense to go, here's what I think made that work. And the background is, I was a, like everyone in here probably, a bright kid who probably did well in school without being driven to do it. I had an interest in anything. You know, I studied everything. Books too. Well, I can't say I studied everything. When I met my wife, I found out there were things I didn't study. But that actually comes up in the story in certain ways. But I was an eager learner, very curious. So by the time I got to certain topics in school, I'd already seen it. I read up. And so school was where I kind of got a chance to hang out and even show off a little bit. But it wasn't where I became a student. I didn't become a student in school. I did well, though, because I would get the grades. And if you get the grades, they go, you know, they let you go. Well, when I got to college, everybody there is just like me. It was an engineering and science school, so everybody was just as nerdy as I was. And the criteria there was not, do you know the answer, but do you have the behaviors to let you succeed in this situation, in this context? And it was very competitive and also demanding to the extent that you just can't kind of casually, like, you know, amuse yourself learning certain things. Some things are beyond amusement. Proving the central limit theorem in probability and statistics is not an amusement. For most of us, maybe for Euler or Bernoulli or some of those people, it might have been amusing. But for me, it was like, oh, my God, what? And so it was different. And I kind of stumbled through my first year. But the second year, I met Linda. No Linda you know, probably, but a Linda. My first actual girlfriend. I mean, really, first, because I was so geeky. I didn't know what to do. One of the areas I didn't master until, well, still working on it. that's a continuous, that's a life study, the sort of the gender mysteries. But I met Linda sophomore year. But sophomore year, I was a physics major, and things kicked off with a fury. And I did not manage, one, being a bad student, which meant I was already holding on by a thread, and then the demands of school, and then, I won't say the demands, but the additional study of you know, being a human being and learning about that. And so I crashed and burned, I mean, in a major way. It was the first time I failed, and it was quite a blow to self-esteem. You know, whatever pride, people look at you funny like, what happened? Well, you know, they don't understand. How could you? You know, but and then my parents understood, but they didn't give me a hard time. But I went home on what they call academic suspension. But that same, in fact, the same day I got the suspension letter, my father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And it was a serious kind. It was aggressive. And so they didn't think he would live but days. And so I suddenly ended up in a crisis in my life of proportions I had never encountered. I'd been in little trouble. You know, start a small fire in the basement. How are we going to put that out before the house is gone? Small, little trouble. That's a, never mind. But my laboratory in the basement oftentimes had drama, but it was typically over by dinner. This was a different situation. And so I found myself in a type of shock and really reflecting on what happened and what was I going to do to fix it. And I don't know where to attribute this to, but I didn't blame the professors. And there was some blame. I could have said, well, here's what happened. Here's my excuse. I had some dental issues. And there is a dean whose nephew and I were running buddies, and his nephew flunked out. And so he decided to make me a target of all kinds of trouble. I could have had any number of stories, but none of them were the truth. They would have been true, but not the reason. I mean, all these things were true, but I could have, if I were a good student, none of these would have stopped me from doing what I needed to do. But I realized that I was not doing school the right way, and that my entitlement to not be a good student, my entitlement to not toe the line everyone else had to toe, was a mistake. And that was hard because it meant, you know, the shine I keep on myself. You know, if you have good self-esteem, it means you kind of give yourself, you keep yourself in a good light in your own mind. And that light bulb burned out momentarily. I said, we got to replace that bulb. And I had been studying a ton of things, and much of what applied for me at that time, I was reading a lot of work. We're talking in the early 70s. So a lot of work on related to growth and self-cultivation was all over everywhere. You know, you get the Whole Earth magazine or something, the Whole Earth catalog, you know, and things like that. There's a lot of resources. And I had been reading works by Gurdjieff. How many of you know Gurdjieff? Good, good, good. Carlos Castaneda. Everybody's hand will go up. Carlos Castaneda. Krishnamurti. All right. I'm going to stop with those three. But what I liked about those three is they were, I would say, I'm going to go for Gurdjieff, ruthless, and Krishnamurti, less ruthless but more matter of fact about how we screw up when we do, and what we need to do to fix ourselves. They rang true in my ear. And so a couple of those things I will present, and Castaneda as well, but Castaneda was more about to do with the how of things rather than the why of things. You know what I'm going to take a pause right here, though. A short pause, and I also want not only my sample of a situation and what I did to get to sort of correct some then evident issues and faults, but I'd like to know if some of you are here now with something that either you're working on or something you think is interesting enough that you would want to, in a way, offer as an example of an opportunity or a need to reinvent. Yes. Kit? Oh, okay.
So I was 14.
Okay.
And
14, yes.
14.
Okay.
And growing up in a troubled family, you know, everybody can fill that in with their own troubled family. And I was depressed, didn't know it. And somebody introduced me to LSD. And I was sitting at the counter in my mother's kitchen, and I was playing with a pencil. And I could bend the pencil, you know, I could tie it in knots. And I was really enjoying it, you know, it was a lot of fun, you know. Gosh, you know, you can bend a pencil, you know. And it suddenly occurred to me that reality was that flexible, that it had flexibility to it, that it was your perception. And I was also reading Castaneda and, you know, a bunch of the other people. So I had that aha moment with this pencil, you know, and I still remember that saved my life.
Ah, thank you. That's cool. We'll reference that. Anyone else have a? Yes, we have one and then one.
What age were you at this time?
I was 19. 19. Just short of my 20th birthday, actually. It was May when I got the suspension. That was May. So I was 19 at the time, turning 20.
Just two memories relative to what you're saying. Struggling with whether suicide was the right thing to do.
Wow.
And having a Nietzsche was a benefit to me in the dialogue because it gave me a way to reduce the ideas to a binary comparison, and I spent, I guess, 20 hours sitting in the chair in a fetal position in winter debating with myself the proper course of action for a rational creature that finds itself existent in an irrational universe in which there is no known beginning or meaning or end, and the only option that seemed to make any sense that was left to you was to decide whether to participate or not. And the evidence was very strongly, since I was irritated at the idea, to give the universe the finger, so to speak, by removing myself from it. And in the course of this long day, I heard a voice yell out from somewhere else in the room, in which there was no one but myself, saying, "I don't care. I like it." And we made a deal to go. The other voice said,
"I don't care.
You know how this is all going to come out. If you don't like it, just wait. Let me do my thing, all right? And we'll meet up later." The interesting part of this is that the time to pay the bill is coming due now.
Oh, Bill. Oh, gosh, don't sign papers under duress. Okay, wow. That's, how old were you?
How old was I?
Yes. Okay. Any, was this a sudden?
No, I had
you had struggled with?
I did time to guess what I like to put it that way.
Okay. We could unpack that, but that might take.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, thank you. But there's something in that, too, that's very, very, very cool. Anyone else have something? Yes.
Yeah, I went through a reinvention period in the late 60s, early 70s. Again, Krishnamurti got involved in his philosophy or whatever. I guess what got my attention was to just get rid of the stuff that was in my brain, that all the structures in my brain, just through awareness, and then allow the creative process to reinvent without me worrying about it. It's through peace that the creativity happens, according to his philosophy. And that idea is what I've been living with through all that time till today. This whole idea of through peace, creativity comes up in reinvention.
So in
without,
a moment...
Without our even knowing what's going to happen, in a sense.
So you did something? Was
just,
it an act of...
It was more of a just... What he said was just observe what's going around you without
observe.
Any interference from your brain.
Okay.
So I tried to do that, and it worked.
Interesting.
It worked. And it was the beginning of my spiritual journey. And then later on, a few years later, I got into the Bible and then cast all my care on God and let peace.
Tried that too?
Then that peace worked even better.
Uh-huh.
But it was all through peace and strength, that creativity and reinvention happens. That's
mm-hmm.
what I was taught, or what attracted me. So.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. Barbara?
Sometimes we need a little help with our reinvention.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple periods of depression, and I went for counseling, for therapy, and, you know, came out of it, was able to make some changes and come out of it. So I think depression is not always such a bad thing. It's telling you something, you know, that you need to do something.
Yes.
And so.
Okay, thank you. Maybe unless you know better than that, whomever you may be, how urgent, how critical, or important, if you're compelled to share it. But if not, we're good. We got some good instances. We have one more. Okay. All right. So we'll go on. These are all. There's typical is not the word. But we all have something like that. And the lucky ones once or twice, many of us all the time, but they're not completely unfamiliar and out of the realm. All right. Thank you. And all of those have something that relates and can, in fact, contribute to this. Well, in my situation, let's see, that May of 8th, on my birthday, May 18th, actually, the storm began. And I, in that summer, made the decision. I heard that. Somebody sent a thought, and I telepathically picked it up. Okay. Made the decision that my option was to let go of aspirational thinking or grit my teeth, and work it out. That may sound like a simplification. Maybe it is a simple, but right now that's how I see it. But similar to, what's your name? David. There was a chair involved. I sat on the chair and I said, I'm not getting up till every part of me reports that it's ready to get real. Whatever that takes. And that, at that time, I'm not sure, but it was an instinct that I was aware that there's inner conflict and we can say one thing and do another. We can say one thing and still know we're hedging. We kind of know I'm going to try, but I was a no buts. I'm not even going to move until everybody in my inner staff has reported, we're on board, sir. We're on board. 100%. And I could not. Somehow that seemed to me part of the solution was to overcome divided energies and divided drives that we may contain. There's nothing to guarantee that that was ever going to happen just because I sat and said so. But there was a point where I started to go, okay. And old folks say, you know, you count the cost. I'm not sure where this phrase comes from. Old Southern women say this, and they say it's in the Bible, but you count the cost. So when you're about to make a change, you don't just go at it with a sort of naive, happy-go-lucky energy. You go, I am serious now. I have really given this, to the best of my ability, a thorough examination, and I know what it's going to take, and I really do mean it. I'm there. So that was step one. But I think I got to that step, though, to reference Gurdjieff. One of the tenets of his model, his cosmology even, is that we are equipped to essentially attain that thing we at one time referred to as mastery. But it doesn't happen. Mastery takes a lot of doing. Takes a lot of know-how. And one of the things one had to learn to do was observe oneself dispassionately. Like you're not an advocate for yourself. You're just an observer. You're not advocating any particular behavior. You're not standing on the side of one part of your psyche or another. You're saying, no, I'm just going to keep my eye on you. I heard the Sting song. I've been watching you or something. Every move you make. That song. I said, how apt, because that song, every step you take, every breath you make, I'll be watching you. And I said, you know, it makes sense to me that if I'm observing myself, the truth will be there. And if I'm trying to have integrity or whatever that is, I'm going to respond to that truth, but it does mean that I have to be prepared to keep watch. And it became clear to me, just in observing human beings in general and myself, that we don't always tell ourselves the truth. We rationalize. We have a superpower to rationalize. It's really like amazing. If you watch the news today, you go, oh my gosh, how could a whole, oh stop, nope. I'm not going there. We can waste the whole. But we can fool ourselves. And I was thinking, well, if I'm not going to fool myself, I have to sit and kind of learn how to see clearly. So I took that on. And after some clear self-observation, I think his phrase is self-remembering. I got a pretty good clear self-description. It's like the police person is, you know, 5 feet, 11 and a half inches, 185 pounds, blah, 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 blah. Tends to hedge on this, tends to not like to study. As a student, I did not do homework. Why? I didn't need to. Why? Because I don't need to do homework. Well, I got my grades, you know. Did you read the material? Well, I'll read it. I'll read it the night before. I've read it already. But it's not a problem. I always get it. So I had identified all of my academic issues as well as the ones that were more general and applied to my life in general. So I had my hit list of here is your diagnosis. Here's what's broken. That's not. But I'm going to say here's what's not working. And I got clear on that. Then I said, From what I'm gathering, the only way to deal with this is going to take a lot of energy. A lot of energy. The other thing I took from Gurdjieff was about energy economics. He didn't use that phrase, but I was an economics student by the time I graduated. And energy economics mattered, and it's appropriate. We have a lot of energy, but we don't realize the extent to which we squander our power in negative emotion. When we fret, when we whine, when we fuss, when we get angry and rant, we're just burning the fuel, burning the fuel. Where is it taking us? Because that's real energy in you and in the world. But it's not taking us anywhere. I'm not saying it's wrong per se, but it depends on what your purpose is. What are you trying to do? What's your aim? And if it's not consistent with your aim, you've got to go, why am I doing that? So I posted my inner sentinel and made him swear that at the beginning of any, and I'll borrow one other phrase too from Castaneda, one stalks oneself, which is to say you learn, like a hunter, you learn your moves. It's like you're an animal and you learn to hunt it. You know what paths it likes, how it likes to avoid, how it darts and dodges and hides. And you know its behaviors. And once you know its behaviors, you can catch it. So I'd done some stalking of myself, and I had resolved to stay on duty and collect this information. And there was a point where I kind of knew how I do things, both good and bad. And I knew it pretty well. The energy, though, to interrupt the momentum of my life is enormous. Let me say this in another way, based on the psychology. Most of us don't realize it, but we live with our past. We live with our memories. Everything we do, skills, moving our bodies, all of that, is something we built into our neurology a long time ago. And the fact that we do it doesn't mean I'm doing it now. It means that I have got a button, that I hit that button, and whatever I stored away executes. So I like this language as a programmer because it's kind of clean and crisp, the idea of code executing. And the brain is a structure. It's a system that behaves roughly analogous to computers. We store procedures and we execute them. When you drive, how many of you have driven home meaning to go to the store? Execution. Why? Because you got involved in a conversation, you were thinking about something, and the next thing you knew, that procedure, that code, took you home because it was built in your past. It works really good because you did things to hone it and refine it. It worked perfectly and pulled you into your driveway, and you went...
The car knows.
Elon Musk would agree with you. But I understand and I appreciate that. I sometimes blame it on the car. Sheepishly, yeah, my car is pretty smart. I taught it how to, but, you know, and so I say, car, listen, here's what I mean. But yeah, we have a lot of code. And in fact, the preponderance of our behavior is coming from there and not in the moment. So here's why I introduce an important player in our system. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Don't worry about it. Just say executive. You have an executive function in your brain capable of interrupting executing code and capable of, for short periods of time, directing behavior. But you can't do it long term. It will exhaust. It's almost like I can walk across this floor without ever exhausting, but if I have to walk on a tightrope and I'm unfamiliar with it, I can only do that for a few minutes before some part of me gets tired and I fall off. I can't hold that together. It's not trained well enough to walk tightropes. And so my conscious effort will exhaust in a short period of time and I'll fall off. So the things we can rely on are built and coded and stored away and called up on demand when we need them. And it's very powerful. Nature evolved that, and it's a great solution for a situation where There's not a lot of change going on. There's a known number of problems. Once you've learned and solved those and you've coded and optimized the code, you can live on that and free your executive for the novelty that will occur, for the special things that occur, for the short changes, because life is not going to be absolutely static. It's going to have variation, but you have enough reserve resources to manage that variation. But the problems are largely solved. And so you can drive home on hour, you can cook, you can, any number of things we can multitask, and we do it effectively because of that. Well, it's that same code that I had to contend with as a student. My code as a student was buggy as it was buggy. And so I knew I had to use my executive to do the training internally to modify my behavior. So that means, one, watching it, one, understanding it, accepting the nature of the problem, two, deciding, making the decision, three, husbanding the energy so I can get through that. Because I didn't just decide I'm going to be a good student. Well, that's handled. 10 minutes later, I'm doing the same thing. Why? Because we have that code. It's alive. It's alive and it's powerful. So it's going to do what, when your thought goes there, it's going to run. Your thought goes there, it's going to run. That's how cool we are. I'm even gesturing. Look at this. How cool is this? I don't know what emphasis I want to make. I'm not saying, okay, when I say this word, I want him, and I'm so I need to do that. And I just feel it. I feel what I want to say. I feel what's going to make that. And I'm not even thinking about it. My body knows how to do the nonverbals that support my verbals. Learned a long time ago. So there's always code running, and it's strong. And that's what we're up against when we want to reinvent ourselves. We have to go, well, you know, this is going to take, what am I going to try to change? And what does it take? It takes a lot of energy. So my second practice that fall, I was supposed to be out for a year getting myself together. My father had surgery in May, but survived the surgery. Other stories. And so I was, my daily activity was, I have a job so I can bring something in the house. I have my activities that, in my mind, strengthen my executive. Because that's one of the important things you have to do, is you have to get your executive to be commanding. It's not. How many of you have had successful execution of New Year's resolutions? Typically, God made a resolution, and then bang, holy moly, February, I'm still on it. March, I'm still on the wagon, all the way through the year. How many of you, is that the rule? It's not the rule, because our resolutions don't hold because we don't go through all the other stuff that makes it hold. So and one of them is, we have to exercise the commanding part of our nature, the executive, for it to be strong enough to manage that system. And we lose it and apologize in our lives all the time. Why? Because we lose it. Because we don't know how not to lose it. Because we're not that strong. But we can be. And there's some people who have equanimity. I remember when Obama was standing there talking to somebody, and somebody says, "You lie." And I saw him go. He had already decided that he wasn't going to give anybody any fuel for their little fires. And in his life, I'm sure he had to learn to manage his balance, because somebody's always giving you the shove. And that's one of those examples of what equanimity looks like when you're under pressure and a lot's going on, and it would be easy for you to lose it and then have to go, "Listen, I'm sorry. I lost it." And the extent to which we're always having to say, "I lost it," is a measure of the extent to which we might need to exercise our executive, the command. So I worked on that so that I would have the energy to interrupt my code when needed and to write new code. Now, I can translate that. So I made my rules for the day. Do my job, go to my classes, do my chores, and hang out with my dad. That was my day. Faithfully every day, I did those things, no matter what. I remember one day it was 11 degrees below zero. And what I did every day was I ran about 5 or 6 miles, had a little route. Because part of it was the physical challenge of running does a couple things. It not only does it make you exercise this, because you're going to want to stop. And to the extent that you keep going, no, 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 a little bit more, no, no. You get better at that. And at some point, that's nothing anymore. You say, what, 6 miles, 11 below? Nothing, nothing. That's a real transition. You can go from, you know, the dope, you know, the soft, way behind the ears teenager to a 22-year-old Navy SEAL if you want to do that. They're not born that way. You build that. And the Army and the services, that's one of the things they do, is they know how to build that grit. Yes?
Question. Did you put it to yourself in those terms when you were 19 and 20 with the programming, the coding, the executive function? Were you actually putting in those terms to yourself at that age?
Not exactly. Those terms have come later. The meaning there, I knew that. I knew that I could get stronger, not simply physically, but psychologically. I knew that was something I could do and had flirted with it. I mean, we all have moments when we have to struggle. We do that inner wrestling match. And I knew it was a reality, but I also had the belief that I could change it. But I knew over time that I could. I enjoyed track and field, and I had played football. Thank God I wasn't good enough to play. I wouldn't be able to make sentences. So I enjoyed it, and I know the first week of training is hard. Summer, two-a-days, three-a-days in a muggy, muddy uniform, and then September and then fall, you're playing in the cold and tough guys, big monsters punching. You know, there was a lot of stuff to work through, so I knew that you could condition at multiple levels. But then when you read Castaneda and you read impeccable, was the word he used, and you read Gurdjieff being ruthless and intentional suffering, both of those sources tell you that you can get better at being in charge of yourself. That you can have an eye. You have a little eye when you start out, but you can strengthen it. And we all have the culture. We watch parents, parent children, and you see children. I had 4 siblings who had watched in various ways. Mothering, helping them manage until they were kind of like, I can take care of myself. You know, we have a lot of sources. But I was confident that I could do it, but I didn't know exactly what it would be like, because even though I believed in change, I had not engaged in that degree till then. But I remember in October, I kind of said, I'm on a roll now. I could feel that if I chose to do something, I could do it. And if I chose to do it and was going to do it, I wasn't going to fuss about it. I wasn't going to, none of that. So I said, here's all the negative things. And there's still some. So you can't see all your negative emotions, because you even know sometimes that mood might be a negative emotion. But I was aware of a list that I said, I will enter any time it begins, I will nip it in the bud. I won't let it grow. What goes along with that, though, is that when you interrupt code, extinction is the word psychologists use, that system weakens. You have to exercise those things. And so what you live on a daily basis stays strong. What you stop doing on a daily basis actually kind of recedes. Doesn't mean it fades completely, but it loses its power, or some of its power. So over time, the executive gets stronger, the bad guys get weaker, and the other good guys you're building get stronger. So you can get a movement from, I really got to get Mac together, to like, I'm really on top of this now. I think I'm ready. And it was that fall that I say to myself to this day, that's when I grew up. And that's my definition of an adult. I've done a couple talks here when I say we need to help people know how to make adults. It's not just making someone who looks like an adult who can hold a job, but someone who can manage that process of in the moment understanding what's appropriate to do and getting it done efficiently. And if we show how to do that, and if we can teach that, then we are going to become relevant in our community, and we're going to become relevant in the world, because that's where human beings are not doing a good job. We're not teaching people that that's just the way I am. I mean, the real people think, well, this is who I am. This is just the way I am. This is how I am. And then they act like somehow there's a cosmic law that says you can't be any other way but that. And in fact, if you change anything, you're not being true to yourself. And you're not being who you are if you don't screw up here like that. Come on. So, but we don't work at it. We don't have a narrative. We don't have a story going on in our society of a certain level that says we can do well. And here's the picture of a grown-up. Not a special grown-up, but a regular grown-up. We need a better target. And we need to be clear on how to hit that target. And we need to put institutions out there, narratives out there, cultural artifacts out there that guide us and keep us going that way. And we'll do amazing things because we are pretty spectacular as a species. Every time I see them 747, I just gasp. I went to the Blue Angels, this, and I looked at a F-35, go, and then pull up into one of those and just soar. And I said, we made that. Didn't grow up a tree. We can sit down and do amazing things when we decide to. Why are we deciding not to do things like save the planet? Why are we deciding not to do things like feed and clothe? We could do anything. So I'm like, we can do it, but you do it inside first. You establish control and some command. And it's not that it's not fun. If we think we're giving up all the fun of life and the joy of life, we'll have life more abundantly if we take that road, to borrow one of my dad's passages. Joy and joy more abundantly. Anyway, so, but I, by that September, I knew I was getting it together. By October, I knew I had it under control. And by December, I was a monster, meaning I had a little jacket. I didn't have much money in my little high school athletic jacket with a little C on it and all had worn out. And I had a little denim jacket, and I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it would get cold in the winter. And I had my little jacket on, a little scarf, but I would go out in the cold and I go, hey, it's just weather. No whining and shivering and fuzzing about it. Some part of me I'd learned to manage, not just finally sitting down and sitting in a chair and reading a chapter and doing the assignments. That was amazing. But once I got that down, but other things. So the idea of strengthening the executive and then training new behaviors was working for me. There was a point that I wanted to come back to relating to that. Let me take a second. And once you build good code, it works for you. And it does automate again. It becomes a resource that you access simply by intending it. But that takes time. It takes time to train. So one of the things about reinvention is, one, manage your energy. Learn how to accumulate and gather your energy and manage it. And accept and understand that there needs to be a process of repetition in order for that to become the asset that you have in mind. For it to work the way you want it to work, there's going to be a period of time where the executive is really going to have to run those training sessions. But at some point, you stop because it's there now. It's alive, and it's doing what it needs to do. So that period of time showed me some major things that still, to this day, play a role in, it is who I became. Is, I will say, capable of doing hard things if I need to. What else is important about that? I have a couple of notes. And if there are any questions, please ask them, but let's see. So we talked about the role of the brain, and we call that learning, but I just think we underestimate learning. But this does take advantage of the plasticity idea. The word we use now is plasticity, that the brain can be shaped and reshaped. Let me add something to that now, because one of the things that's changed now, I was young. What does that mean? My mitochondria was really functioning better then than it is now. Or I put it another way, my experience of my energy was different then versus now. So I would say that what was true for a 20-year-old, now we're talking 66, is different. But I also found that there's enough information about how to, in addition to behaviorally, become efficient and minimize the loss of energy, there are also ways that we can use existing knowledge to enhance our energy. So if anybody's having energy issues, I would say consider B vitamins. I would say consider something called acetyl L-carnitine, which is a amino acid that supports the mitochondria. That's the motor of your cells. If you get that motor improved, you suddenly feel like doing things you may not feel like doing before. And if it makes you feel like doing things and you start doing those things are going to strengthen something. And then you feel more like doing. So there's a momentum strategy that we seniors need to be aware of so that we can still go, I can get myself where I need to be, but it's not the same path that I would use as a 20-year-old, where it's already there for you. So now you have to learn how to manage. You got more code to unwrite sometimes. And you may need to rely on more supplements and more external things, but it doesn't matter. Do it. Do it. We eat food. It's like, I'd rather not have to do anything. I'd just rather be self-sufficient on my own. But actually, life has a, you know, there's this swirling mix of things, and we are as much external dependent as internal dependent, and so don't fuss about that. Do what you have to do. So energy is one. Manage energy. And if there's anything I had to leave as a check mark, play with the idea of doing self-observation, understanding the places where you break, make yourself a couple simple rules, and don't get crazy, just kind of be modest. Because the other good thing about strategy is that if you always set yourself up to succeed, you take out of the story the consequences of negative experiences, because you get negative reinforcement from failing and you get positive reinforcement from succeeding. So try to keep yourself doing something that works. And so when something fails, it's not a big deal. It's like, well, I still have the best batting average on the block. You know, hey, I'm good. As opposed to, I hope this works. I really hope, you know, Charlie Brown, I really hope this works. You know, so one of the things is modesty lets you win. And when you win, you keep trying. You keep going. So there's a phrase now they call healthy stress. So you want something challenging, so you at least can pat yourself on the back for something. But if you do baby challenges, you're going to get bored and quit. But if you go for the Herculean, you're going to die like John Henry. You know the John Henry story? And so there is something in between those extremes. Okay, let's see. I talked about the fast to get a... So reality, the word reality came up. And actually that comes back to the word of tools. One of the things that is a powerful asset that's not typically available is the fact that we have multiple modes of mind, one of which gives us an opportunity to more powerfully adjust our code than another. If I use the word hypnosis, will it weird anybody out? Hypnosis is a state of intense internal focus, or intense focus in any case, and the word suggestibility suggests that one part of our system that is critical in sort of controlling what we believe or don't believe is less attentive. And when that part is less attentive, we can create internal scenarios without the accompanying doubt. And that's a powerful state to be in, because if you can get tentative in a place that was hard, if you can get tentative again, it's an opportunity to then train a new thing without the interference of the other thing. So hypnosis is a way to say, listen, if I could just get this crew to quiet down for a minute, I can train this crew on something else without the interference, and now I've got a new asset. And there are some substances that also put us in a similar state. But for those who want to explore the idea of, if I'm going to try to plan a new idea, what's the opportune way for me to do it without taking risks, like trying to find your connection for LSD? Who is that, by the way? Who was your hookup? Yeah. You may. Probably. I'm gonna run away from that. Okay, but I'm gonna introduce a couple things. So, for those of you who meditate, you already know that there is something about becoming very quiet and very still that turns off a lot of those programs, a lot of those circuits that dominate our lives and behavior. And to the extent that we become skillful at becoming quiet, we're partway there to being in a place where we can create tentative realities. We can try things without a lot of interfering from operating code. And that's really the key, is to get free of the machine for a little bit. This wonderful machine that's doing amazing things, but we still have to get free of it to try some other things. And sometimes that reinvention will mean I need to get myself to try this. And if it works, I need to repeat it, because with the repetition, I'm writing new code and strengthening that code. And then I get a new thing. But I got to be able to, one, do it once, and then I got to be able to repeat it. And then I learn something. Since I'm living in my past anyway, I'm living in my memories, I got to have some memories that come to me when I need them. Because all of our behavior, right, essentially is called to mind. I like to use the phrase, called to mind. When you hear a noise, you don't know what it is. That noise stimulates a process that calls things to mind. Was that a car backfiring? Was that a gunshot? Is that the television? Did something fall off the shelf? I mean, boom, and your brain does a quick analysis of a noise. And so all of that, what they call transderivational search in the brain, it has to figure out from all your stimulus what is actually happening. So that reality is coming out of your brain, not out here. What this does is turns on an experience of stimulation. And then that stimulation turns on your process of search and recognition and interpretation. And then that's where your reality comes from. But things that let us quiet that process down free us to introduce new stories. And if you design a story related to where you want to be, so you as a reinventor, you're going to re-engineer yourself. You build yourself a picture. Here's where I'm going. Here's what I want. That's what I want. You know, you get that emotional energy going, that's what I want, I really want, I really want, I really want it. Say it 100 times really fast, really, really want it. Once you get that picture, then you have to go, how can I get some bits of that going? So half of the job is to stop something. Stopping is a big strategy, and then starting is another. And that's all executive work. But when the executive's done his work, that new thing is alive and there for you. So I think of myself as an organization with many parts, some artistic, some scientific, some mathematical, some a lot of things, but they've all been trained to do certain things, and they all had experiences that built them, and so I might need to do some new experiences to build a new part. So in this moment, I would say takeaway, though, that you do need to know where you're going. Make a blueprint, make a schematic, tell yourself a story, in some way represent with as much detail and fidelity as you can what it is you want to invent. It could be simply stopping a habit. I want me, but without the cigarette, for instance, some people will do. I want me, but with 2 glasses of wine instead of the bottle. And there's any number of strategies, you know, there's things. So you pick that, and they could be anything from a complete makeover to simple, minor things, but still might be challenging. But when you get that clear, then you begin to talk about strategy, which means, of course, knowing that you're going to have to stalk that behavior and learn how to interrupt it and be honest about it. Once you get good at seeing yourself, you go, hey, watch, this is how I smoke. I first get agitated. I kind of look like this. I take a moment. I go, and then I have a moment of the last, when I take that breath, and when you have that experience, then you suddenly go, okay, I just think I'll have one. And there is a story that you do that's part of your execution of that code. And once you know it, you can interrupt it. Right? That means the executive's got to be good enough to stay on duty and keep observing, and then to pull the switch on that process when the time comes, and then even to substitute a behavior. Substitution is a good strategy too. It's not good enough just to stop something. It's better to replace it with something better. It's better. to do that if you can. So have something ready. And how many of you are familiar with the term neuro-linguistic programming? You know, it's based on classical conditioning. All it is classical conditioning. It's just, you know, the brain is an associative machine. Like the doggy, if every time the bell rings, there's a steak. If you do that a half a dozen times, the bell can ring, and I'm like, where's my steak? Give me the steak. You know, dogs, people, all of us behave that way. So it is associative, so we have to learn how to set up our own, you know, bell steak loop so that we get that behavior. But once we've done that, I mean, let me say it, that's the executive job to decide to do it and then to preside over that, to manage that. That's a manager role, to manage that process. And then you can have that. Things that help. Stopping. Getting quiet. And meditators know that once you practice with the little monkey mind, you know, once you wrestle with that monkey while you understand something about what it takes to be aware that it's off again and pull it back. You've all been through that experience that meditate. You know it's going to go. It's the nature. It's job, though. We evolved in the wilds. We didn't evolve in Berkeley. We evolved where we need to be aware of things. And when noise and stimulus happens, we have to attend enough to know if it's something to respond to or not. The monkey's not bad. The monkey's got things to think about from yesterday, problems to solve tomorrow, and it's got other things to monitor in the environment, so the monkey's not bad. But if you decided, I'm safe, that's decided, so I just need you to be chill, then you have to know how to bring it back. And in fact, discipline is so that the monkey will sit with you. That's the ideal. Me and the monkey, we just sit together, quiet, doesn't get in my way. And then you can do that. So one of the things that the neuroscientists are telling us is that we have brain states. With EEG equipment, we can monitor the correlates, the brain's correlates of states. And typically when we're meditating, we're either doing alpha, which is kind of quiet, open awareness, but not engaged. Present, but not engaged. Or theta, quiet, and in fact half asleep, meaning I've withdrawn my inputs for information from the external world. And now I'm attending to internal stuff, so we call it unconscious. We're close to the unconscious, and we're just short of falling off into unconsciousness entirely. Well, the alpha state, at least, is quiet enough that you have your energy at your disposal and can do with it. And in that state, you're also not letting bad patterns run. Number two, it's partway to theta. And if you get to theta, then you can run stories. You can tell yourself stories in theta. And Interesting thing about the brain. The experiences that you have in mind code in the body as reality. Let me say that. When you are having an intense internal experience, all the same systems that process an external experience are engaged to process the inner experience that you're making. Another way of saying is, I can be coded by something outside in my world, or I can be coded by something in my imagination. So, to me, my imagination is my workshop. My imagination is the workshop where I go and go, here's what I want. I want to release this into my world, but I'm going to code it here. I'm going to build it and test it and refine it here. And once I've got it working really reliably here, by the time I've gotten it working, it's now part of me. That's the imagination. Now, the imagination has a certain intensity to it, and it competes to this. If I say, imagine the beach, how about imagine the Golden Gate Bridge? Well, while you're looking at me, you can imagine the Golden Gate Bridge, but which stimulus is the strongest? I hope it's me, anyway. But if you close your eyes and get quiet, and let the internal become the store, the life experience at that moment, then the intensity, and I'll underline the reality of that, goes up compared to external reality. So one of the good things about inner experience is if you get good at it and you're selective about it, that inner experience can teach you, develop you, evolve you, practice you. Athletes now, when they get injured, their sports psychologists will say, it's okay, Steph Curry, while you're mending, you'll just meditate and practice your shot in mind. Because when you practice that shot, the same wiring that does it on the court is doing that now. And you will hold, and they've tested that, you will hold a skill and can in fact improve a skill simply doing it in your head. So, that's your laboratory. That's where you build new things and test them out. But the trick is to make that space powerful. And you make that space powerful by suppressing the external challenges to your data, to your experience. And then that inner experience becomes all powerful. So when you've had a really intense dream, that's what happened. You did not have the external world. You weren't aware of it. And yet what's going on here is real. Is that a tidal wave? Oh, you know, you have all the feelings. You have all the... So I had a dream like that. I watched the tidal wave just come. I was like, oh, no, what's this about? But one can rehearse and practice behaviors there. And I would say there's any one thing that we underteach that has potential for enormous impact, it's using that inner space to rehearse and practice new behavior, new skills, new responses. If your little brother upsets you whenever he does so-and-so, why don't you go and imagine yourself there and just let him do it. And just see yourself not react. And just do that 100 times. So at some point you go, really, you're doing that again. And there's a point where you can learn a behavior. Nothing happened. He's still doing what he's doing, but your experience is different now. So that's a treasure that we under you. So how do I get there? One of the cheap ways to do that, I mean cheap in terms of time, those of you who meditated for decades may not agree. Because we've spent, you know, we don't want to buy his remorse. But there are some tools available today. Feedback, biofeedback is a tool. A good hypnotherapist is a tool. Something called entrainment, where you can take a stimulus of a certain frequency and expose yourself to that. And at some point, your brain processing that frequency will begin to resonate with that frequency. All of those are ways to get into theta. And it's in the theta place is where you are the director, writer, and producer of those experiences. And if you can practice getting there in on that set, then you can write your scripts and practice and rehearse and create those realities. Is it time to stop for questions? Because this can go on for weeks. But I just want to, I know there's a few chunks out there for those who might want to discuss anything, and we'll have enough time to drill down on things we want to unpack a little bit more. Yes. We have a question here.
Well, I completely agree with everything you said, and this is very, very powerful. What I want to bring up is the moral aspect, because with this program, we can become super empowered. We can use our superpowers for evil just as well as we can with good. So the piece I'd like to bring in sideways, we don't need to discuss it today, mm-hmm. but is working on the hidden parts of, it's called the shadow. Mm-hmm. I think the term is misused and misunderstood. There are parts of ourselves that escape the witness, that are actively hiding from our own selves. Fortunately, usually the people around us are very clear on what our shadow is. We are usually the last to know. There are plenty of cases where people have, through hard kind of programs you've been talking about, usually more the traditional meditation techniques, have achieved very, very high states of consciousness but taken their shadow up with them because the traditional meditation techniques don't address this. And you can end up using your superpowers to become Darth Vader instead of Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Search your feelings. You know it's true.
If you only knew the power.
If you only knew the power of the dark side.
You know, I have a question. I have seen documentaries showing that individuals who have done terrible things, when made aware of the impact of those on others, feel empathy. Can learn empathy. I don't know how that works in the sense that if I make somebody know really all of what they did, is there a human part that says, I don't want to be that. I don't, that's not what I meant. That's not what I want. I didn't realize. I didn't know. If I had known, I never would. I don't know how much of that is built in, but I agree with you. But I also add to that, the reason I joined this church is because I am serious that we are in trouble. We have to do something. And I realize there's going to be organizational power, not individual. And we need organizations that are prepared to ask and act on these questions around morality and conscience. And that it has to be a church also that's capable of relating and interrelating with other churches without the same dogma. And that if we, and maybe the 20-30% of people who are engaged in organized religion, begin to get the same skill set, that's enough of us to become a movement that then can manage the dysfunctional ones among us. And it might be like an immune system in a body does respond. Good cells respond to some bad cells. It may be that we have to engage in being prepared to confront the shadow actors and redeem them in whatever way we can find. And so one is an outside strategy where I need to be able to at least be impactful and to teach and say, listen, just give me a minute. And I got to be ready to show something that's worthy of, you know, that for their moth is a little bit of a flame. You know, I got to be ready to do that. And that's one of the things I hope we do as a community here is begin to sort of curate a body of knowledge and programs that we run here that for our community, that's what we do well. And then we relate to other church communities. But I don't think it's a personal thing. It's not just personal. We are not just personal living people. We are part of an organism. We're part of a body. And I'd like for us to become collectively well. But that's a good question because I didn't address that, but it is in the story. Yes. Any other questions? That's a good question. Yes.
So I want to comment on your question about our ability to change. I work in San Quentin. My reflection on it, I mean, we're talking the word penitentiary out of the Catholic monastic tradition. Well, it isn't really penance. It's reflection. You can't apologize for something until you know what you've done. But in this process, I don't know, there's a separate process where I see the men come into the program because they've decided I am not living the life that I want to live. I call it the door to wisdom. And I think it's built in. I'm not saying it works for everybody, but yeah. One of my other reflections is when I read Bible, and I read, you know, God says, well, if you do this, I'm going to bless you. And if you do that, I'm going to, you know, the reality of that is when we live in community, we are living a blessing. When we live outside of a community, we are, in fact, living in hell. I mean, okay. Can you imagine what these men's lives were like before they came to prison? That's my comment.
Okay. Interesting. But this happens, meaning they arrive at that question. They arrive at that question about their life and the meaning of it independently. Is that, because I think that is a question. Some of us are committed, it appears, committed to a dark path without being in the pen. Okay.
In fact, in pulling us back into communities is my guess.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. That's interesting. I am curious about the forces. Again, I'm not a despot who can tell the bad people you're going to be good or else. I mean, that doesn't work. You can't put a gun to someone's head and go, okay, get good. It's not how it works. Yes.
by way of complimenting you, and I hope it comes out this way, you already put your finger in the electric socket while you were sitting on a box of the Encyclopedia Britannica before your mother knew it. But the tradition to which you belong is part of the human history. Organized religion is a manifestation of earlier attempts by wise and thoughtful people to provide a framework to search the inner self. Mm-hmm. And for me, I should say, the key issue is your engagement in whatever is now being learned about the organism. My initial proposition of a accidental prefrontal cortex able to look out at the stars and say, what the heck is this, right? That still holds. And the use of the language of new discovery to describe inner phenomena that previously were described by other terms, all right? The organism is essentially the same. That is to say, we may now talk about it in terms of coding. Somebody else talked about it in terms of demons and so forth. I've just spent the last half year engaged in a foolish, fruitless, fun debate with two born-again Christians who offered me Christ and good music, and I had to turn them down, sadly. nothing I could say about Babylonia or Gilgamesh and the Bible and Noah. It was clearly not coding, but the demons that the Jesuit had told me, asked me in point of fact, as a literal phenomenon, not a metaphorical phenomenon, right? So in that sense, it's intriguing to me to have grown up in a world full of magical things. My mother told me to spit three times if I was frightened, to throw salt over my shoulder to keep the demons away, and now to be talking to someone who spent an awful lot of time peeling the onion skin, as it were, of his psyche away. I just want to attach one notion to this, and then somebody will come and take this out of my hands as they're supposed to. attached to this remains the fundamental question that keeps coming up. You hear it again and again, even in our time, as to whether there is a reality. You're engaged quite properly, and I'm emphatically in support of it, as to whether or not we can modify the organism on a scale large enough to save the next generation, for example, from something even worse, which the same organization has perpetrated on all the other species that here, right? There is an argument that says, it may seem preposterous, that we are an unfortunate accident and we will carry out the mission, which is to eliminate ourselves so that the cosmos and this particular planet can go on its merry way, having done very, very, very well before the accidental formulation of RNA and then DNA and all the rest of it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, but somebody, so if you have something to say on the connection between the growth of brain studies and its relationship to computer development and the language as somehow an improvement over the magic and mysteries that have been the explanation, the Jesuit says to me that things are the way they are because it is their nature, and he thinks that's an explanation, right? Mm-hmm. So, if I have made any sense at all, probably not, between where you are, the language you're using, the studies that you've clearly gained much from, and the fundamental question of what is human existence in this structure, as opposed to the question of whether we can fix ourselves.
Interesting.
I just draw on that idea.
The spaceship just left.
I'll be quick. I think one of my metaphors is that we are cells on a large body. And if you can imagine, you know, one of the cells on my follicle here or something, having a wonderful life, knowing what it is to be a good follicle and how to deal with local cells around me and all that. But it might try to guess about the nature of hand, arm, body, and even the nature of what this body is within this larger context, but it can't, it's not designed to contemplate that. So I think we have to say, probably we're in a bigger thing than we can grasp, and that's okay. But what we can grasp, we can do better with. There are consensual experiences we're all collectively involved in that we can do better with. And that's our meaning and that's our reality. I don't know that there's an ultimate reality. My understanding is that I have a biological system that can respond to certain things. And the things I'm not built to respond to, whatever it may be, I got no clue about. But it's there. But I got to deal with what's here. So I fully believe, like animals that don't have eyes or plants that don't have legs, they have a full life, but they don't have the life and experience I'm having. They have a reality. They don't have the reality I'm having. So with all the differentiation of life forms, there are different realities. But is there something happening of which we can influence our experience of it? Yes. And that's reason enough to do something with that. But I don't believe that we can throw a big net over the whole thing. And if we have that need, it's going to take a lot of sitting in whatever state it takes to throw that big net. Even if I have an amazing and transcendental experience sitting, I'm assuming that whatever happens to me is about the whole. I used to have the Jehovah's Witness knock on the door on a Saturday morning, and they get the papers and want to save me, and I'm a polite guy, so I listen for a minute. But then I said, but you know what? If the most grandest, radiant being came around the corner right now, taller than you can see, his head, and you would go, oh, God, I'm doing your work. And then it goes, oh, by the way, no, I'm actually not God. God is bigger than and more, we can't see. So the greatest thing, we tag it, God, but we don't know. We don't know. And we have to be okay with that. But that doesn't take the meaning out of the moment, out of the now, and out of the feelings. And then we're having experiences. And so I go, oh, it's not real. It's in your head. No, this is real. I feel it. And I don't like that. No, it's real. And that to me is where we have to work. And the rest, when we have broken this vessel and leaked out into a bigger pond, and I don't know what that'll be like. I have the idea that we'll pick it up and go, okay, now what's going on? And we'll just keep... I believe life goes on, but that's another conversation.
I'm afraid we ran out of time. Thank you very much for an excellent discussion of your toolkit.
Thank you. I'd like to say that my belief in this community probably includes activities and possibilities that exceed what we typically think about as what our community is doing. I would like it if we decided to form some kind of way to create the programming that supports systematically assisting our membership in their growth. Systematically, not simply from the pulpit and from the covenant, but let's find the knowledge. And let's pick the times and let's schedule the work for us to do this journey. And in that way, we leverage and combine our strengths and our meaning and relevance. I just want to suggest, and I'm going to be probably putting together at least a first draft of maybe our proposal of maybe how to approach it. But it's an open question to this community. But I want us to not walk away going, okay, that was interesting. Back to, we're supposed to at some point interrupt a trajectory that's not our chosen one, and produce a trajectory that is chosen. And I just want to extend the invitation that let's think about it together and let's find a way to do that. Okay, I am done. Thank you.